Welcome to Into the Nuance, compassionate, evidence-based pre-med advising. Join us each episode as we unravel the complexities, debunk myths, and explore the many paths to medical school. Whether you're a freshman or a pre-med veteran, we are here to provide informed, realistic, and hopeful advice on your journey. Tune in for interviews with experts, stories of triumph, and useful tips as you continue towards medical school. This is Into the Nuance, and we are so glad you're here.
All right. Hey, guys. How's it going?
It's the end of the year, so, you know, we're plugging through, but doing well.
Yeah, no, I'm so ready for it to slow down for a couple of weeks and take a breather before application season starts again. I can't believe it's actually that time of year again where we have two cycles going overlapping, and I need a break.
You got a good staycation in store.
Yeah, same. I'm not doing anything. I'm going to stay home and bake cookies and just relax for 2 weeks.
That sounds amazing. I am flying back to multiple different families, my husband's and my own. So we're going to try to find some rest, but it's also a travel holiday for us.
Sounds stressful.
Yeah, we're getting pretty good at it this time since we live away from family, but we have talked about needing a separate vacation just to rest, right, when we get back.
Holiday vacation, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's hard to believe that 2024 is almost over. It's been a wild year. Lots of interesting things happening this year with applications. And I don't know, you guys can tell me what's been wild about the MCAT. Should we do like a year in review and talk about all the things we learned this year as advisors and instructors?
I think that's great. I mean, I feel like it's something that is really useful to kind of see like were there differences in the 2024 cohort versus what we're expecting to see in 2025, or are the lessons we learned going to apply to this next group? So yeah, I'd love to do that.
Well, I have a big one. About a year ago, we were all anticipating this brand new FAFSA that ended up being a bit of a problem, and it changed, I think it affected the admissions process a little bit in that we saw much later acceptances because schools were kind of holding back until they got their classes settled. And this last year, I would say, was pretty wild with the acceptances coming out really, really late. I had people getting acceptances in June and July, way more than I have, and interviews coming out late. So it just seems like the process is just slowly evolving to just go on longer and longer. And I don't know if that's a FAFSA only thing or if there's some other issues with like interviews, but that was a big thing this year.
Yeah.
I'd say as compared to last year, what we're already seeing this year, it seems like interviews are coming out even maybe earlier this year though. So I don't know if that's a rebound compared to last year, if it's like a response to like, geez, we started pretty late and got ended pretty late. And now we're trying to fix that problem. There's even some schools that we've heard of that are just done doing interviews already. They've already filled out their waiting lists and just straight up said, we're not going to be doing any more interviews.
So I was
a little surprised by that, to see like a couple of the UCs have done that and said, we're not bringing any more people in for interviews for any reason. So it feels like maybe they've overpopulated their wait lists. So they just can say they're done. And even if they have to refill from the wait list, they're pretty confident it sounds that they'll be able to do it from what they've already collected up. So that could be a reaction to how it did go so very, very long this year.
Yeah, I'm sure it sucked for the schools to have to go so late too and to scramble to lock down their class at the end of the summer, you know? So I imagine that if I was in those meetings with admissions officers, we would be getting told by the higher ups to make it an earlier process.
Get it over with faster. Yeah, I've heard rumors through the grapevine, just chatting with admissions people, that there are schools that ran out of their wait list last year. They flew through everybody. And I think you're right, Doug. I did see earlier interviews this year, and I that maybe it's a response in that they just are playing it safe and they're being more aggressive and going after a lot more people faster, like you said. But I don't think it's over. I don't think it's going to be over for a long time. I keep telling my applicants, like, we're in this for the long haul. We're going to be interviewing until I would guess March or April for a lot of schools.
It does seem that there's a difference depending on this type of school, right? I mean, obviously the UCs that have, a ton of applicants and they kind of get their pick of the litter, they have the option to make it an earlier experience. But these newer schools, these like younger accredited schools, it seems to me that they're really trying to fill cohorts that are like the right fit. Is that accurate, Joanne? Because
Oh, I think so.
I've seen students be like, hear from schools immediately. Like I had one student who's now working with me as an assistant coach, and he got a acceptance without an interview at one of these newer DO schools because they were like, "We really like you, and we really want you, and we want you to know that we like you." So, whereas other programs, I think, have told my students like, "We'll think about an interview later." So you're on the wait list for the interview, which is like the opposite experience. So I find this very fascinating because it felt like a much more standard experience when I was going through the process, almost 10 years ago, and it's just really destandardized.
Oh, for sure. A lot of the rules that used to be in place, I used to operate under, a set of rules that we understood. This is how admissions works. I joke all the time that admit now it's like the Wild Wild West. Like every year something wild happens. I'm like, really? Like this is happening? I mean, this you would have never heard of that happening 10 years ago. So I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I don't know what kind of wild thing is going to happen this year where the admissions offices, something comes up, whether it's a natural disaster and things have to shift quickly, or another admissions crisis where they run out of their wait list. But things like the rules that we've always played by are no longer in place. Like I'll give you an example. Multiple times in the last 3 years, I have had students who have been rejected and then interviewed and accepted. Like denied, done with, before interview. And then
Wild.
the school said, "Oh, oopsie, we were just joking. Come on in." And I mean, that's just like unheard of. That's really sloppy admissions, but just stuff like that where I'm like, you can't even believe a rejection anymore. Just hang tight, we'll see. I mean, we'll see if they really reject you.
Yeah.
It's
I do
really
feel like for students, I mean, I know we've talked about this, Joanne, a lot, as students come to me right around this time of year, January, early February, and they say, "Hey, I haven't gotten any interviews. I have applied this cycle, but I think I might need to reapply. When should I start restudying for the MCAT? Because I'm still in the cycle. I still haven't heard, but I also don't want to wait to the point that I'm rushing my next year's application." And it's such a, like, I have such a hard time navigating that with them, right? Because we want to be hopeful. We want to, put the good juju out there that they're going to get that interview. And I don't want them waiting till March to start their studying experience if they're going to be taking it before the next cycle. So, Doug and Joanne, I'm sure we've all experienced those conversations. I had one last week with a student who was like, "All right, it's mid-December. Haven't heard anything. I know my MCAT score is lower than I would like it to be. What should I do?" So, do you guys have any kind of best practices that you tell students in those situations?
What do you think, Doug?
I mean, those are always tricky conversations, because you're right. You don't want to put too much doubt in there because like there's still a really good chance that somebody's going to get accepted. So what I try to play it off a little bit, just like, "All right, well, let's do some studying, but we don't have to be super serious about it. You don't have to read books, don't have to rewatch videos. Let's just to do some daily practice and just to keep yourself familiar with the MCAT. And should things come up that you don't recognize, then okay, then maybe do a little bit of digging into the books and things, but don't take it super serious at first until like, but so they're at least doing something." And honestly, that's when I think people improve the most, is when they're not super stressed out about it, about shooting for a particular score or shooting for, like hardcore studying. They probably are not bringing with them that baggage of, "I have to do this, I have to do this." And it's more, I think, honestly, for some, oftentimes people tend to do better that way because they're not doing it super serious and it's not creating all kinds of anxiety. So I try to play it off a little bit like that, where it's just like, "Eh, let's do a little bit on the side and see how it goes." And hope for that acceptance. And so you can just drop this whenever that happens. And I'd say more than, 75% of the time they get accepted in the cycle, and then it just ends up being like, oh yeah, I wasted my time a little bit, but it wasn't too bad. But it's going to be good for them in the long term because they're also getting better at things like USMLE and Comlex too in the process.
Yeah, that's been kind of my like line is okay, if you felt like your MCAT was your best effort and you felt very good about the experience and you don't need anything else from that experience, don't study until you need to. But if the MCAT brought up some anxieties or some bad study skills that you're worried about continuing into medical school, then use the studying for the MCAT while you're in this waiting period as less of for the MCAT and more like, let me develop my study skills or let me develop my reading skills so that when I get to medical school, it will be like I'll have more confidence in those skills. So I'll usually ask them, like, was there anything about it that didn't feel good in your experience? Like maybe it was building flashcards, maybe it was reading Carr's passages, and just work on those as a skill thing, kind of to your point, Doug, of like, it's not a big deal. It's not really for the MCAT. It's not very serious, but it does feel like it was valuable time. And I do have some students that are like, yeah, the last thing I want to be thinking about right now is the MCAT. And then it's like, okay, then we'll be pulling teeth every time you try. So it's not really worth it.
That's usually where I start. I'm like, do you want to study for the MCAT? And if
Yeah.
they're like, no, and I'm like, okay, well, let's talk about what you have and what we can do with what you have. And if they're like, yeah, I know I can do better, because there's some people very motivated by that. And they're like, I know I can do better. I just want another shot. And I'm like, go then, run, do it, you know, because if you want to, you should always do what you want to do.
Yeah.
And you'll be motivated. But most people don't really want to. I talked to someone today and she had a 507 and she applied to MD and DO and only had one interview. And I'm like, I don't know, I don't know that your MCAT that's really keeping you from getting interviews right now. A 507, you should be getting some interviews from DO schools. So we talked about it, we looked at a lot of things, and we actually realized that it had nothing to do with her MCAT. There were some other problems in her app. She didn't work with me. She did it on her own. And she realized that, we just identified some other issues. And so she was going to retake her MCAT before she talked to me. And then she realized, like, I don't really need to do that. I just really need to revamp my app and use better strategies next time.
Yeah.
So,
And that's often the case, right? We've seen so many
yeah.
times that it's not the MCAT doesn't open any doors that weren't open anyway, right? So
Right.
oftentimes, like, what's the best use of your energy in a retake experience or a reapplication? And I also say students, like, hey, if you're not sure that you need to restudy, like, aren't there other things in your life that you would maybe want to do instead? And like, maybe prioritize those. And maybe those are experiences for your app, but maybe they're
Yeah.
also like life things that'll help keep you motivated through the next cycle because it is such a painful experience. Just I like the worst time in my life was sitting waiting for interviews that never came. Like that was just it's like a Chinese water torture where it's like every day you're hoping for that email. And so doing life things that are enjoyable during that time versus forcing yourself to study for the MCAT, I think can be a better approach for a lot of students.
Yeah,
And a
for
lot of
sure.
times the students don't actually know or understand what a good score for the MCAT is. And so if they've gone down that rabbit hole, which so many of them do during that hurry up and wait period after they submit their application and then secondaries and they're waiting and they start reading Reddit and stuff and thinking like, oh my gosh, my 509 is not a good score. I have to retake a 509. Like, whoa, let's talk about that. Like 509 is a perfectly fine score for getting into MD and DO and whatever. And like, you actually run a bigger risk of getting a lower score because you're burned out and, stressed out about retaking on a 509. So, it's a lot of times the conversation does end up being what is my score currently good or not good enough to get me through that hoop, or get me over that hurdle, I should say.
Yeah.
So, I often find myself redirecting students that have those types of scores. And although some of them just refuse and they're going to just do it anyway, and they're going to try to get a 515 the next time. And
And
sometimes
sometimes
that's
they do.
successful,
And
sometimes
sometimes they
it's
do.
not.
Yeah.
I mean, I got my 508 when I first took it, and my immediate thought was like, oh, okay, I could do better. And I did. And it was great, but I spent 11 months doing that. Would it have been better if I was a true good pre-med student to work with somebody like Joanne and actually think maybe I should use some clinical experience. Like one clinical experience would have been useful instead of studying for the MCAT for 11 months.
I'm not laughing at you, Amanda. I'm just like, oh no.
I will tell you, like, I was like, oh, what I need to do with my 508 is get a 520 instead of research experience, clinical experience, actually showing I wanted to be a doctor. And that's truly how I spent my year, was making money and studying for the MCAT. And that was probably the least of, like, if I really wanted to go to medical school, that was the least effective thing I could have done with my time. And we do see students, to your point, Doug, like that they assume that that's what's holding them back. And most of the time it's not. Right, my 520 didn't get me in any more than my 508 did. So it's one of those things that I think is really useful to talk about and like be like, okay, like realistically, is that the feedback I'm getting or not? But I'll be curious, right? Because last year we had so many of those. Like last year, I couldn't tell. Like I had a bucket of students in February who were like, "Do I take it? Do I not?" And we had Joanne. We had a student who started with me doing MCAT prep and then 2 weeks later got into medical school. And so it's like we had so many in that category last year who ended up getting in. I'll be curious with Doug's point of them kind of doing earlier acceptances if we'll see that this year or if we'll see like, okay, if you're not getting an interview by January, like that's a more realistic signal that we should reapply, right? I'll be very curious to
I've
see.
also been seeing a lot more straight up rejections coming earlier this year too. Seems like schools have been a little bit more willing to reject out of hand applications. Although, to Joanne's earlier point, who knows if those are real or not, because maybe they might reverse that decision.
Well, I don't know why they're rejecting anybody if they are having this issue of flying through their wait list. I mean, I don't know. I'm not in their shoes. Maybe they already know they have enough people, but I think I'd be going a little bit more conservative if I were a school, because at this point, people are sport interviewing, and you all know what that is.
Just doing it for the doing it.
Yeah, I am so anti-sport interviewing. I really discourage people from doing that. I tell everyone, don't go to any interview that you don't really want to go to. It's such a waste. It's unethical. But I know for a fact there are people out there doing that. And so as long as people keep doing that, how in the world are they supposed to know who really wants to come to their school? They're interviewing people and wasting their time, and they may end up in the same boat as last year. So I don't know. Only time will tell. We'll find out in 2025, won't we?
Yeah, and that did that come from like n moving to virtual interviews?
Yes. Yep. 100%. And that's the issue, is that they have no way to discern anymore who actually wants to come to their school. In the past, there was, and I see more and more schools adding in-person interviews for that reason, because that's the only thing they have to work with.
Yeah, that was a new thing this year. Is a couple of the med schools I've encountered are going back to in-person interviews. Or they're giving options. They're doing an either or. You can do in person or you can do virtual. And hands down, I will always say if you've got the option, there is no option. You go in person. Because, I mean, you get number one, you get far more than 30 minutes with them to interact and show them how much you want to be there. You learn more about the school and you're just going to show your interest better. Like if you have an in person option, you're going to show them that you mean business because you're spending your hard earned money to travel to these places and like that's an indication that you're really willing to and that you really want to come to that school. It's not it hasn't gone it hasn't rebounded back to pre-COVID levels by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, I've found that this is possibly one of the most interesting ethical quandaries for admissions, like in my personal opinion. Like, I don't know how they feel about it, but I think this is a real challenge, right? Because, okay, you want to make it equitable. Virtual interviews absolutely increase equitability because if you can't afford to travel to that place, but you really want to go, now you have that option. But if you do virtual and in person, there's going to be a bias for the in person. Like, there's no way for there not to be a bias towards the people that are in person because you're like subconsciously, you're just connecting more with that human, right? But then, so then is it like, okay, but then is that punishing those who really want to be in person, but then literally can't afford to get there? So they choose the virtual option. Then you have the interviewing for sport issue where it's like, okay, but we also need to show like genuine interest. And it's just like, it's such this fascinating, like I know it's a big problem, right? Because it's like, how do you make it equitable? How do you make it fair from like a financial perspective? But how do you also make sure that you're getting a cohort of interviewees who genuinely want to be there and are not just doing this for the experience? I have no answer for that, but I do not envy the people who have to make that decision because it's tough.
Right.
And I know, Joanne, you were in that position at a school. Like, do you have like a what you would think would be best
I have like a
practices?
thought. I just had this thought, and I don't, I mean, I'm again not an expert in this, but like, so people get anywhere from, 1 to 15 interviews, let's say. And at what point do they have enough interviews? Like, I would say probably 5 or 6 interviews is enough. If you can't make a decision with 5 schools, you have a problem. So let's just say, all the interviews had to be sent out by December 1st. And all the interviews. So everyone got the interviews, and you had to pick your 5 schools to interview at. And then there might be like a second round interview. It's kind of like the match, but it's a little bit more transparent. So like, you have to decide which 5 schools you're going to interview at, and that's it. And then after that, 5 schools, you go to the interviews, and they're all virtual. And then from there, you can either rank or you can find out some other way. But I think if people could had to limit, and I think there should also be a limit on how many schools people can apply to. I don't think people need to be to 50 schools. Like, let's say they cap it at 30 and you get 5 interviews, and it shouldn't be a sport. It should just, there's no egos involved. Everyone has the same amount. No one's better than anyone. And
Like you can only choose 5 schools to interview at, kind of thing.
Yeah, and you have to scrutinize your schools before you go to the interview. So it's selecting. It makes it, and then the schools know, okay, this person is really serious about me.
I know that I think would require a unified front from the medical schools to do. So
There's
that
no
may be
unified
challenging.
anything in this process. They can't even agree on prereq.
So that might be a pie in the sky. I have heard from my students that some of them are doing virtual interviews, but then in-person like visit days for the interviewees. And so I can see like I gave just a loose recommendation. I'm not an admissions expert by any means, but I basically said like, unless you really want to go to that school, I wouldn't go to those days, right? Like if you're already getting other interviews, prioritize going to those days of the schools you genuinely want to go for. And like, because that way, if happens to be on the same weekend, you can really choose. And I think that shows interest too, right? To Doug's point of like you're spending money to go there. And they know the list of students who show up for those in-person days. And I think that does signal like, yeah, I really want to be here. Plus, it's useful for the student, right? Like you want to make sure you go to the campus and like
You
meet
want to
the
see where you
actual,
might make a friend.
exactly. So, but it's a tough process. And I think giving students grace, but also weirdly giving admissions officers grace a little bit of
Oh,
like it's a
for sure.
very tough thing to try to balance getting the right cohort with also making sure that you fill your seats. And it's a logistic nightmare in my opinion.
Well, I've seen two new things happen so far this year with this cycle. And it's not new. I've just seen different schools doing different things. So one tool is that the schools, like one school sent out a survey to the accepted people, and they basically asked 3 questions. They said, I 100% know I want to come to your school. I'm still considering other schools. I'm not coming to your school. And that's post-accept. So the people, my applicants, of course, immediately were like, this is legally binding if I put, are they going to rescind my acceptance if I put that I'm looking at other schools still? And no, it's just a tool for the school so that they have some idea. If you are literally still shopping for other schools, be honest and just say you're shopping for other schools. That way the school knows, and they're going to have like, okay, these guys definitely are coming, which is not a legal binding document. If you get into your dream school, you go. But I think that if everyone is honest and transparent, include especially the applicants, and then tools like that can be really helpful in helping the schools manage their lists. Another school just sent out an email last week, and it basically said, if we are in your top 1 or 2 choices, send us a letter of intent. And they
Nice. Oh,
assuming they
that's
want a
good.
nice written. So this week we've been writing letters of intent. But I, and people are asking, should I do it if it's not really? And I'm like, no,
No.
only do it if it's your actual top choice. It's not
Yeah.
complicated, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea because like a letter of intent is work. So that actually also prevents students from like you want to put good effort into a letter of intent. So
You
I
also
think
see
that's a
the
great idea.
flip side in letters of intent where the students also think if I send this letter of intent, somehow this means I can't accept at another school because there's some like legal, like I don't know where how this whole legally binding phrase comes up for a lot of the students, but
They're just afraid.
If you send in a letter of intent, then you get another school, another acceptance. It's just like, okay, that's the dream school. That's
Well,
you're
you should not have sent a letter of intent if
you
you're
shouldn't have
waiting
sent
to
the
go
letter of
back to your
intent in
dream
that
school.
case. But at the same time, even if you had, it's not like something that's going to keep you from going to the dream school. It's
No,
not a
people.
legally binding document or anything like that.
So letters of intent are also a sport, and people with egos try to wrap up. What I'm trying to say, they're trying to get as many acceptances as possible. So that's something like at least when I was in admissions, we didn't even care about letters of intent because when we saw one, it was there had to be something else that convinced us that they really want to come because people would just letters of intent get accepted and then turn around and withdraw 2 days later. They just wanted to have that acceptance, and that's like sport acceptances. That stuff drives me crazy. I do not like playing those games. I don't think people, at least with my applicants, I'm pushing hard. Like, don't play games like that.
Bad karma. Not that we're relying on karma on the process, but yeah, I think it's for the same reason that I would never go take the MCAT. Not that I can legally, but also like I don't like the idea of like there are coaches out there who like go take the MCAT for real for students, and it's like okay, like we can just respect that there are those seats because right now it's so hard to get seats for the MCAT, and it's like taking up a seat just because like a coach wants to see what their how high they can get their score. Or like a student's like, I got a 5.16. I've already gotten to medical school, but I'm going to take it again. It's like, okay, like I have heard that from students, and it's kind of and it's kind of a similar thing to like racking up acceptances for the sake of acceptances, even though you've already gotten into your dream school. It is a bit of an ego thing, and I know you've worked really hard and all those things, but like we have to respect that this is an incredibly competitive place where there just literally aren't enough seats. Like there aren't enough seats in California for people to get their ideal test spot, right? There aren't enough seats in medical school for people to go. And so doing it for fun, like that's okay if there's if
Another
you aren't taking it
level.
away. Yeah, exactly.
That's a
And like
very expensive hobby, and honestly, that is scary in my mind. Like, you have nothing else better to do than try to get a higher score. I don't know. Me and people would not be friends outside of that situation.
And I'm like, hey, take as many practice tests as you want. If you want to take a practice test and get a 528 to prove that you can get a perfect score, please do so. Just don't take a seat from a student who's like desperately trying to get that January 10th date, right? That's kind of my, I don't know, Doug, if you've seen that, but like I have had to, like, I've interviewed some assistant coaches who said that they've done that. And to your point, Joanne, I'm like, I don't think you're the right fit for my group.
No, absolutely not.
I mean, what I've been seeing is that already in 2025, it's wrapping up to be like harder to get spots than it was in 2024.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing as well.
And I've got people that need to, like, that I've advised that we need to push a test date back. We can't get anything. There's nothing available before June because they're all gone. Like not just California, but like Nevada's out. Arizona's out, Washington's out, Oregon's out, Idaho's out, anything remotely close. And like in the past, like in past years, usually mid-December, you start seeing the January slots open up a little bit and maybe a few March because people are starting to push back. They're getting cold feet. They're canceling. That hasn't happened this year.
Not as much in California.
And like there's nothing, there's still nothing going on in California. It is dead.
In January, you're saying they can't get a seat in January at this point?
At
No.
all. Or
I'm seeing
March.
movement. Yeah, I'm
January to
seeing
March,
movement in
zero.
other states. Where like, because I tell students too, I'm like, go on the 30-day deadline, get in there on those wait lists, things like that. But the wait lists are so deep that the students can't even get on the wait list. And so I'm a little worried. I don't know. And I would love to do some digging and maybe Doug, if you have some insight, I can't tell if there's just more students taking the MCAT and the same seats because we're not getting any more seats than we got last year, pretty much. I've checked the Pearson VUE dates and stuff. They're all the same as last year. So maybe we just have more students, right? Maybe we have an incoming class that's bigger, or we have people, and I don't know who's telling them to do this or if they're just doing this. We have students who are sophomores, juniors, or maybe just not ready that are just signing up for a date to sign up for a date. And I don't know if that happened because the October registration has become such a like getting concert tickets to Taylor Swift vibe to it that people feel like I've just got to get a date, even if I'm not even planning on studying yet. I don't know. It's like this weird thing where there are like by the end of October, there are no dates until June for a lot of my areas that have a lot of pre-meds. And that stresses me out because I don't know if that just means like, okay, are we just getting way more applicants coming in, which is like good, but also scary for application cycle, or are we just filling spots with people who are definitely not ready to take the MCAT and they're getting advice from somewhere telling them to just try it? That's my worry as an MCAT coach that I've seen a little bit is so many students come to me on a retake attempt, and when I ask them about their initial attempt, they took it when they weren't ready. They were like, I just took it because I was told to take it my junior year, or I just took it because I wanted to see how I did and I didn't realize that the score was real and that I had to keep it, you know, like, and so I don't know if that's more, I don't know where that's coming from, and I don't know if that's new, but I'm concerned that these spots are filling up with people who aren't ready.
I have had an uptick in students that are saying, like, I want to start preparing when I'm a sophomore. Have you had the prereqs yet, even? Like,
Like we're
have.
not
Like, it's still,
ready.
like, it's, if you end up doing a gap year, your MCAT's not, you're going to have to take it again because of that, because
3 years.
your MCAT can only last for 3 years for most of the schools. So.
So I don't know what the push is, to be honest. I don't know, but I'm seeing the exact same thing, Doug. Like all of my students either got their spot in October or have been having to go on wait list to get their spots. They've been getting them. There
Like
has
we
been
can't even get
movements,
on wait
but
lists here in California. There's no wait list. Even the worst spot in California to take it, which is like, it's this little place. It's near Vandenberg or Brandenburg or Vandenberg. I can't remember which one. Wherever they shoot the rockets off from. It's like nobody wants to go there because it's so hard to get there. And
Even
yeah,
that
that one
spot.
is full and no wait lists because the wait lists are full. And like at this point, I had a student have to reschedule to Canada.
I had a student take it in Guam once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this
Well, I had a Guam
it's
MCAT.
crazy.
So I'm a little worried about that. And I'm a little worried about that because I don't know why that trend is happening. So I would say like that's my 2025 worry a little bit is that students are taking the MCAT without thinking through it, without getting prep, without doing their best effort, and then they're going to end up with scores that they're not happy with on their application. And I think I'm not sure if this is coming from the internet. I'm not sure if this is coming from just like a cultural thing of like wanting to get something completed on their checklist for pre-meds, right? But that's something as an MCAT coach that I'm trying to put out more literature and remind students that you take the MCAT when you're ready, not as like, let's see how it goes. This is not a let's see how it goes kind of test. So that's my going into 2025 mission is spreading the word to undergraduates. We don't take the MCAT until we're ready. So I
That
don't know,
needs to
Doug,
be
if we can be
dispersed
on a
across
team
the
on that.
country. Yeah,
Yeah,
that needs to be on
shout it from
college
the
campuses.
rooftops. Yeah.
I know. That's scary. And yeah, I have so much more to talk about with that.
Yes.
We are going to have to carry this conversation into 2025 because I can't wait to see what happens. I mean, not in a good way. I don't want to see this crisis unfold, but I have a lot of people taking the MCAT in March, and if it doesn't go well, we're all expecting them to jump into a May date, and if that becomes a problem, we're gonna have some problems.
Yeah.
So that's what's scary.
So maybe we can all recap on this
Well,
next time and see what we're seeing.
the one thing I think is the saving grace on that is February. All of a sudden, we'll see a whole bunch of spots open up in the spring because that happens every year. February opens all the rest of the year, and a lot of those people
People
that were
move.
waiting, they're going to move. And so we usually see spots open in February, quite a few spots open in
So
February.
Doug and I will keep an eye on those
Yeah.
registrations and we'll report back once those dates open and see if hopefully that trend is going back to normal.
Yeah. Well, I hope you guys have a wonderful holiday season and a happy new year. And I can't wait to carry this conversation on next year. Until then.
Till then, I'm Amanda Brehm. I am from the Brehm Method. You can find me on brehmmethod.com or YouTube.
I am Joanne Snap from My Honest Advisor.
Doug McLemore with ICOSA Prep, and we'll see y'all in a new year.
Bye,
See
guys.
ya.